believe everybody's got in and greeted a few and got their East Side Enlightener newspaper read. So time to get to work. I'd like to welcome our visitors before we get started, though. We're studying Exodus and wandering in the wilderness. Lessons right now coming out of Exodus and where we are in the story. For those who may not have been here or are visiting, or all of it, I talked about the captivity in Egypt of the Israelites and how Moses was born and his upbringing and how he was actually sent out of Egypt and lived in Midian for a while, and there he met the Lord at the burning bush at Sinai, and as the Lord had him something to do, so he goes back to Egypt, talks to the Israelites, presents the Lord's case to Pharaoh, whose heart has been hardened, and no longer knows of Joseph and Joseph's history, and Pharaoh's reluctant to let him go, to say the least. And Moses and the God of heaven are most compelling to let them go. It takes 10 plagues to prove this to Pharaoh, and eventually does let them go, and still tries to retrieve them there at the last minute as they're crossing the Red Sea. Of course, the Lord lets them through the Red Sea on dry land and drowns the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. We also have started our journey to Canaan, but not the direct route. They weren't ready for that. The Lord wasn't ready for them to do that. Probably a better way to phrase that. The Lord had an appointment with Moses at Mount Sinai. And so the travels go down the western side of the peninsula, Sinai. And that's kind of what we talked about last class. One of the other things we talked about last class, and we've been bringing it out through the lesson so far, is how these events around Exodus and wandering in the wilderness come into play in the New Testament and help us understand the New Testament so much better. We have a good foundation of the history of the Israelite people, because all this is leading up to Christ. All this history of the Israelites and the earth and mankind is all coming up to Christ and his life and death and resurrection. So we try to bring stuff out from the Old Testament that applies to the New Testament. We went through several examples of that, and even in today's lessons, there's some more. I got one shared by me from a friend that I wanted to share with you also. I thought it was really good. So we'll look at it, and then we'll do a little bit of a review of their journeying in the wilderness, and we'll get started. Next to 16. Verses 4, there's talking about the bread from heaven, which the Israelites called manna, and manna actually meant what is it, because they didn't know what it was, but it was actually bread from God. But God was kind of put a little test to them, see if they would do what he asked them to do. And he had asked them to gather, verse 4, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. So they were to go out and gather a day's worth, one omer for each person, about two quarts for each person. They brought it back, and they kind of weighed it out so they'd have equal amounts. And that was all they were supposed to gather. On the sixth day, y'all remember, they were to gather twice as much and save it for the seventh day, the Sabbath day, and no more, because there wasn't going to be any the next day. If they tried to gather more, or gather on the following day, they kept extra, they're supposed to eat it all and throw it away. But if they try to keep it extra the next day, remember, it's full of worms and it stunk. So that was, Lord only wanted them to do exactly what he told them to do. Pretty simple thing to do. Gather every day. How much, what to do with it that day, and on the sixth day gather twice as much. Pretty simple. They had problems with that. And some of them gathered more than they should and tried to save it, and some of them didn't gather twice as much on the sixth day, went out on the seventh day looking for it. It wasn't there. I guess they went hungry that day. 1 Corinthians 11, There was a problem with some who were not doing what they're supposed to do. It's something we need to apply that applies to us today. Verses 20 through 22. Therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. For in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others, and one is hungry, and another is drunk. What, do you not have houses to eat and drink in, or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I do not praise you. So you see the example of the manna and what they were supposed to do to partake of it in the Lord's Supper, and how the Corinthians had perverted that and weren't doing what they were supposed to do. We need to be careful when we observe the Lord's Supper that we do what we're supposed to do and not use it for common meals and eat more than we should and fill up on it and things of that nature, because that's not the purpose of it. And we have good examples in the New Testament of what the Lord's Supper is about. So I want to share that one with you. Also, I know this map is hard to see from where you're sitting. Hopefully you might have a map in the back of your Bible to look at. I'm going to bring this up too. So they crossed the Red Sea, which the Red Sea is right here, is how, what we call it today. Of course, these fingers, these Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba, those are more modern names. We have no idea what they called them back then. For all we know, this was just an extension of the Red Sea, both of those. So where they crossed, nobody knows. But they crossed the Red Sea, and they've gone into the wilderness. And this was also brought to me by a friend. Jeremiah 2. You know, you often wonder how the land was back then versus how it is now. Especially the land of Palestine or where the Israelites end up, what land of Israel, how it was back then versus how it is now. But this, we have a real accurate description of how this area of the Sinai was that the Israelites were wandering in back then. So we, without a doubt, know how this was. So in verse 6, of chapter 2 of Jeremiah, neither did they say, where is the Lord who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, who led us through the wilderness? Here's the description of the wilderness they were traveling in. Through a land of deserts and pits. I don't think there's any deserts there. Through a land of drought and the shadow of death. Through a land that no one crossed, where no one dwelt. And then he talks about when he brings them into the promised land, I brought you into a bountiful country to eat of its fruit and its goodness. So, the wilderness back then is probably like the wilderness we know over there today of Sinai. Now, Israel, on the other hand, God had promised them a bountiful land with flowing with milk and honey. And we'll later on in the story, we'll learn as spies are sent into the land to spy out the land, what they found. Now, whether you can find that there now or not is a different story. But I wanted to share that with you. So, travels we talked about Wednesday night took us across the Red Sea and down the western side of Sinai. They didn't take the direct route in. God didn't want them to. They weren't ready for war. So they go down this side, they first go into the wilderness of Shur, then down to Marah. What did they find there? Anybody remember? They were thirsty, they found bitter water, and God told Moses to take a tree or some kind of vegetation and throw it into the water, and it made it sweet so they could drink it. They'll travel on to Elim there. Remembers anything about that? Don't call any miracles there, but there was 12 oases and 70 palm trees. Now we got 600,000 men plus family, relatives traveling. That was probably a pretty good place to camp. They get into the wilderness of Sin, travel from there. Something significant happens in the wilderness of Sin. What is that? Are they happy again? No, they're traveling in the wilderness, and it's about about a month after the travels, and they get hungry, and they complain they don't have no food. And the wilderness is Sin. Of course, Sin has nothing to do with being bad. It's just a name. Maybe attached to Sinai. But that's where God promised them food, promised them meat and bread. And that's where he sends a covey, a huge, giant covey of quail. And also provides them bread from heaven, which we just talked about, the manna. That happens in the wilderness of Sin. From there, they are taken to Rephidim. A few things happen there. Anybody remember some of them? There's no water for them to drink there. So God directs Moses to meet with some elders. They go a little bit ahead, go to a rock, and he directs Moses to strike the rock. And water comes out of the rock. And I think that's significant, not out from under the rock or out from around the rock. It says it came out of the rock. So we need to remember that in our stories when we tell others, and not try to explain a natural phenomenon. But it was truly a miracle. Something else happened there, anybody recall? Had a reunion of sorts. Yep. His father-in-law, Jethro, right? And his wife and two sons come and meet them there. Now, his wife and sons had originally went to him with Egypt, but we don't know, the scripture doesn't tell us, but you could suppose that with the difficulties Moses was having there and the threats of Pharaoh upon the Israelites, he probably sent his wife and sons home in Midian, back to live with her dad. And here we have a reunion. This is where Moses, Jethro, who is a priest of Midian, the elders and Aaron come with Moses and they worship together, offer sacrifice together to the Lord. The next day, Moses having to hear some of the problems that this probably million plus people are bringing forth to them. So it takes them all day to listen to these problems and try to answer them. So Jethro gives them a plan on how to handle that, and that's to appoint men in groups of thousands, hundreds, and tens. I remember right. Maybe another number in there. But and have them answer the smaller problems, and then the significant problems, Moses would have time to consider those. And they adopt that idea. So that was good advice from Jethro through the Lord of how to handle that situation. So, now we'll get to where we are. So we're down here. Rephidim is right near Mount Sinai, which is there, Mount Horeb, as it was called earlier. They arrive there in chapter 19. This is the third month after they had left Egypt. They arrive at the desert of Sinai. So Sinai is probably the prominent mountain there. So everything around that's the desert of Sinai. They camp in the desert in front of the mountain. So that's a pretty big camp, I would think. Don't know how far around they stretched around the mountain, maybe all the way. Don't know. That's a lot of people. So they're down at the base of this mountain camping. Moses goes up to God there at Sinai. The Lord had calls him from the mountain as he's going up. And he tells him to say to the house of Jacob, the people of Israel, that you have seen what he had done for them in Egypt. All the miracles there, all the plagues that were brought upon, and how a lot of them affected the Egyptians, but the Israelites were left unaffected. film affected both, but all that evidence of how great God was, how strong he was, how powerful he was, and how he took care of them, how he elevated them, how he carried them on the eagle's wing to himself. So how they were special to him is the point that I get out of carrying you on the eagle's wings. Then we get one of those if-thens. We talked a little bit about the if-then statements that we brought up. I brought up another example of that. And this is one. If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. And it says, even though the whole world is mine, and indeed it is the Lord's, you will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now that calls to mind 1 Peter in chapter 2. So we're bringing some stuff forward. How it applies to us today. Verses 4 and 5. This is how Peter the Apostle sends a letter out to Christians. Is coming to him as to a living stone rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up the spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. And then down verses 9 and 10. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of the darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. So we see the kind of a parallel there, and we study this story of how God elevated the Israelites and made them a special possession, a holy nation, a kingdom of priests. And then in the New Testament, we see how we're a holy nation, a kingdom of priests, a special people to God. So let's keep that in mind. The problem with these if-then statements that a lot of our religious people struggle with is they tend to get things backwards. They tend to reverse these. They would say, if you're a treasured people, if you're the Lord's, if you're a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, then you would obey him fully and keep his covenant. But that's not the way the Lord says it. There's something for you to do, for you to get reward. It's not just God, by his grace and mercy, giving you the reward, and then because of that, you do this thing. You see kind of the elements of Calvinism in that. That because you're saved, you're going to do this stuff anyway. That's not. This example and so many more, we'll see going through the Bible, it's the Lord wants us to do something. And when we do that, when we listen to his commands and obey his commands, then he has a reward for us. So that's something we want to keep in mind. So we see it here, and we'll run across it again. So Moses goes back and he summons the elders of the people, sets before them all the words that the Lord's commanded, and the people all respond together, we will do everything the Lord has said. That's number one. Okay? Alright, we'll count these as we go through. So, we'll do everything the Lord has said. Moses brought people's answers back up to the Lord. The Lord comes to Moses in a dense cloud so that the people can hear God speaking to them and put their trust in them. And you got to think, we have this huge group of people. If you remember back when the Amalekites attacked, Moses had to get up on a rock for everybody to see them. And if, you know, they couldn't, if it wasn't on that rock, they probably couldn't see them because they were, as they were battling the Amalekites, they would look for them. And as he had the staff of God lifted up, they were successful. And when he got weary and couldn't hold it up anymore, then the Amalekites were being successful. So it's hard to address. And of course, as the story goes, Aaron and Hur helped him hold up his full of rock. So he sit down and helps him hold up his arm, and they win over the Amalekites. Doesn't totally subdue them, but they win this battle. And more on that later. But as you can see, to address a lot of people, it's difficult. But here you have this huge camp around this mountain. And this is God putting, of course he's done it many times before, but without a doubt, they will see his stamp of approval put on Moses and what Moses is trying to do for them. So, and this is, they've seen awesome things, and I mean that in the most sincere sense of the word. They've seen awesome things before. But what they're about to be is truly awe-inspiring, that they're about to witness and are witnessing now on Mount Sinai. And you'll see from their responses how it is. So he tells them to go to the people and consecrate them today, so, and tomorrow. So 2 days they're to be consecrated, to wash their clothes, and be ready on the third day. They weren't supposed to have conjugal relations with their spouses either for this. And then on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai for the people to see. So, that's what the people are supposed to do. He gives them some limits. He tells them to do not go up or touch foot of the mountain, touch the base of the mountain. And the penalty was they would be put to death by stoning or arrows. So they would be untouched. They didn't do this, and they were try to go, if they would go up to the mountain and try to approach it, they would be unclean, so they weren't to be touched, and they were to be killed by stoning or arrows. And the sign will be all clear when the ram's horn sounds or a trumpet sounds. It should probably be, this is in verse 13, a long, continuous sounding of the trumpets. We'll hear the trumpets in a minute, probably in a different fashion. So on the morning of the third day, there's thunder and lightning, and a thick cloud covers over the mountain, and you hear a loud trumpet blast. This might be an undulating, perhaps, but not the continuous one. That isn't all clear. So this is truly an awesome sight. Everyone in the camp trembles. Moses leads the people out of their camp, and they stand at the foot of the mountain. Don't go up, but he leads them to the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai is covered with smoke. Cloud is really a smoke because of the fire the Lord had sent, descended on in fire. So smoke is, it says smoke billowed from it like a furnace. And the whole mountain is trembling violently, so it's a huge earthquake. This mountain's just moving, shaking. And you know these people standing at the base of it are wondering, what's going to happen to this mountain? Is it going to fall on us or what? So they got their attention. They hear these trumpets of the Lord blaring. It's got to be awe-inspiring. Sounded louder and louder, the trumpets. And Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. So they hear Moses address God, and the voice of God answer him. The Lord descends to the top and calls Moses up the mountain. He says, go down. So Moses starts up. The Lord tells him to go down and warn people not to come up. Just another warning not to come up the mountain. The priests, and the priests must consecrate themselves. Make sure that the priests have cleansed themselves. Moses says, the people cannot come up. You've warned us before. But the Lord tells, go down and bring Aaron up with you. He says, the priests and the people must not force their way through or come up, or he will break out against them. So he's telling the people that. So he goes down and tells them, the people that don't try it. even if you're thinking about it, it's kind of the flavor I get on it. As this is up for chapter 20, we get the Ten Commandments. He says that I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of slavery. And we start seeing the Ten Commandments. And as we go through these, you can kind of think of how some of these might apply to you or apply to others. And a lot of you, I'm sure, know these by heart. You shall have no other gods before me. Number one. You shall not make for yourself an idol. And he's talking about any likeness or anything in heaven, above or on earth, or in the waters below, anything. You shall not bow down and worship them, for I am a jealous God. So, not only don't make them, you're not to, if somebody else make them, you're not to worship them. God says he'll punish the children for the sins for of their fathers, the third and fourth generation, but show love to 1,000 generations of those who love him and keep his commandments. And he's talking about this importance of worshiping him and not worshiping idols. That will be important in a future lesson. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who takes his name in vain. Think about that once you hear on TV, see on Facebook, and all today. Often, a problem. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So it was before this when the manna was sent, it was a Sabbath test, but now it's a law for them to keep the Sabbath. 6 days you'll do labor and do work, 7th day, no work. Not you or anybody in your household who's visiting with you, who's working for you. And he gives the creation as an example how the Lord had made the earth in 6 days and the 7th day he rested. This is kind of significant because they'd lived so many years as slaves in Egypt. And when you're a slave, you work 24/7. And now he's telling them, you've got a law, you're to rest on the 7th day. Something to think about today. I know we don't keep the Sabbath. You know, what do we do on Sunday, on the Lord's day? Are we thinking about worshiping him? Or thinking about what we got to do on our next job? You know, where do I need to make next paycheck? Do I need to go to work today? Things of that nature. Something to think about. Number 5, honor your father and mother. So you may live long in the land that he's about to take them to. 6, you shall not murder. 7, you shall not commit adultery. 8, you shall not steal. 9, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And 10, you shall not covet. That's anything. Your neighbor's house, his wife, his manservant or womanservant, his ox, his donkey, anything. He says, don't covet. So, we've all heard those before. And we'll bring those up more in the future. So the people were afraid of God. This is chapter 20, verse 18 through 20. When people witnessed the thunder and the lightning, the sounding trumpet, and the mountain in smoke, because they trembled with fear, they stood afar off and said to Moses, you speak for us and he will listen. So they were so afraid of us, they was asking Moses to speak for them, lest they die. If you got time, you can look at Deuteronomy 5, verses 23 through 29. It'll give a few additional details of how they were afraid of God. But we won't go there right now for sake of time. Moses told them not to fear. The fear for God has come to test you so that the fear of God may be with you and keep you from sinning. So all this is set up so they can really see how powerful God is and encourage them not to sin because of what he can do. So they stand afar off while Moses approached in the thick darkness where the Lord was. The Lord tells Moses, tell the Israelites, you have seen for yourself that I have spoken to you from heaven. Do not make any gods to go alongside me. Do not make gods of silver or gold. Interesting that he brings this up right at this point. And in the near future, we'll see kind of why. He gives instructions for an altar. is to be made of earth, and sacrifice their burnt offerings, or in peace or fellowship offerings, offer their sheep, goats, and cattle. He says, wherever I cause my name to be honored, I will come to you and bless you. He said, if you make an altar of stones for me, do not build with dressed or cut stones. If you use tools, you have profaned it. So if they were, they could build an altar out of earth, so I assume out of clay or something of that nature. Or they could build it out of stones, but they weren't to use stones to cut them. They weren't to use tools to cut the stones. They would just gather stones and stack them up for an altar. He also said, do not build my altar on steps, lest your nakedness be exposed on it. So if they built their altar, they just built it at ground level, so when they went up to worship it, they had steps, and they went up in their robes, then I guess the people would see up their skirts, so to speak. So he didn't want that to disturb the altar, you know, what was happening. So he directed them not to do that on steps. Here we're going to jump to chapter 23:20. They have these laws. We're going to try to cover these towards the end of the class. They're important. I don't want to make you think that they're not, but I try to think of an analogy of the commandments versus the laws are given, and the one that came to my mind is a recipe. The Ten Commandments is kind of like the necessary ingredients when you're trying to do a recipe, so you have a list of ingredients that are really important. And the laws are kind of instructions to prepare your recipe. Both of these are necessary for successful results. You can't just have a list of ingredients, go to the store and get them, come back and throw them together and expect something out of it. You have these instructions. So I kind of parallel that with the laws. These laws we're going to go look at briefly will help them keep the Ten Commandments. And they both had to, you had to have both of them to be successful. One's easy to remember, a list, the Ten Commandments. The other must be closely followed to get the correct results. But we want to jump ahead, cover some more of the story, and as time permits, we'll go back and look at some of those. That's it. He promised that he sent an angel before you to the place where I promised. So this is God's promise and trying to tell them what to expect coming ahead. Pay attention, listen. Do not rebel against them. He says his name will be in this angel. If you listen carefully to do all, then I will be an enemy to your enemies. So that was quite a significant force. If they would do what he wanted them to do. He said the angel would bring them to the land of the Amorites, Havites, Philistines, Canaanites, Horites, and Jebusites, maybe. I don't know. I have a problem remembering all those. But the promised land. And he says, I, God, will wipe them out. He tells them, do not worship their gods. You're to tear down their sacred places. Worship God and be blessed. You'll be blessed with food and water. No sickness, no miscarriages, no barren women. You'll have a full lifespan. Great promises. God's terror, this angel will be ahead of them. Enemies will turn their back and run. The hornet will be sent out from them. So even if they were greatly armored, no armor then could cover a hornet going in, flying in the into the whatever they were covered with, God would send a hornet. He also says, but they weren't to be driven out in a single year because the land would become desolate and wild animals would increase their population and be too numerous. So, until their population could build, they were going to be driving out these enemies over time. So, these are promises of God. If they would do what they're supposed to, this would happen. Little by little, the enemies were driven out so they could increase. God would set their borders, he said, from the Red Sea to the Sea of Philistia, or the Mediterranean Sea, from the desert, I presume the desert they were in, to the river, which that river would be Euphrates, which is a long way off. So it was going to be a good piece of land. People will be handed over to you. You'll drive them out. It says, do not covenant with them or their gods. Do not let them live in your land, or they will cause you to sin. And their worship to their gods will be a snare to you. So, Lord told Moses to come up, you, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders. All but Moses are to worship at a distance, and the people may not come up with them. That's in chapter 24. Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws. They responded, all the words which the Lord has said we will do. That's number two. Then Moses writes it all down. That's the Ten Commandments and the laws. The next morning, Moses builds a 12 stone altar representing the 12 tribes. They sent young men to offer burnt offerings and peace offerings of oxen, and I would presume it's young men because they're handling oxen, which oxen need young men to handle them. Moses puts half the blood in bowls and half is sprinkled on the altar. In Romans 12, verse 1 and 2, we won't turn there, but we're told to present our bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, not conformed to the world, but transformed. So, we're a sacrifice today as we look back on this. Moses reads the book he's just written, the Book of the Covenant. They respond, it's number three. All the words which the Lord has said we will do and be obedient. Moses sprinkles the blood on the people. He says, this is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to all these words. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? If you turn to Matthew 26, verse 27 and 28, you'll see a statement by Christ when he's given the Lord's Supper, Matthew 26, 27, 28. Then he took the cup, and gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remissions of sins. You see how this goes forward? These words that Moses, as he sprinkles it on the people, these promises of God. I mean, Christ uses a similar phrase when he institutes the Lord's Supper. So you'll see Paul referencing this in 1 Corinthians 11. Verse 25. So Moses, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 elders go up and see the Lord. Under his feet, they see a paved work of sapphire as clear as the sky. But God didn't raise his hand against his leaders, so they saw God and ate and drank. Apparently the peace offering had just offered. Now, the burnt offering was totally consumed, but the peace offering was cooked. And some was offered to the Lord, and some was left for those who did the offering. So this is apparently what they ate and drank. But they ratified this covenant made with God with this meal. And we ratify our covenant with God every week when we partake of the Lord's Supper. We have a meal with the Lord. Ratifying the New Testament covenant, that we're living under it, and we're striving to live according to God's laws and ordinances each week. So we're ratifying that. The Lord tells Moses to come up and stay, and I will give you tablets of stone in the law for the law and commands I've written for your instruction. So Moses and Joshua, his aide, go up. Joshua probably didn't get to go all the way up, or didn't go all the way up, apparently. But Moses will go all the way up. Aaron, Hur, and the 70 elders will stay and wait to answer any dispute from the people that may arise down below. But you got to think about the faith of Joshua and the tenacity to go up with Moses partway and wait there for 40 days. While Moses is up talking to God, Aaron, her, 70 elders are down dealing with the people. And he's just kind of up there alone. Waiting. Not knowing what's happening on top of the mountain or down below. So you kind of see why Joshua becomes a good leader later on because of his faith. Moses goes up, then the cloud covers the mountain, the glory of the Lord rests on Sinai. It waits 6 days. And on the seventh day, the Lord will call from him in the cloud. The Israelites view, they're seeing the glory of the Lord. It looks like a consuming fire. Moses enters a cloud as he goes up the mountain. So we see Moses disappearing in this cloud and this fire above. He'll be up there 40 days and 40 nights. And they're just kind of waiting. You know, what's happening to Moses? 40 days. This will cause them a problem because and we'll see that in the next lesson. Well, the bell's rung. What I got next? That's where the story ends. Some of the laws. We got laws conserving servants. Hebrew servants were to serve 6 years and be free on the third. Laws concerning violence covers premeditated and incidental murder, manslaughter, kidnapping, fights, cruelties of slaves, things of that nature. Animal control laws, control of animals, liability and restitution for animals, or if they've done damage to others. We have laws on the responsibility for property, theft and restitution, liability of a borrower, things of that nature. Moral and ceremonial laws concerning fornication, sorcery, bestiality, worship of other gods, treatment of strangers, widows and orphans, reviling God, cursing rulers, delaying offerings, or eating meat killed by beasts are covered. We have laws of justice for all people concerning defamation, mobs, partiality, aid, or bribes, hospitality to strangers, etc. And then law of Sabbath. They were to sow 6 years. And gather from the land, but the seventh year the land was to lie fallow, and that was for poor and animals to take from the land. And of course, 6 days work and 7 days rest. And then we have, three annual feasts they were to keep. The Feast of Unleavened Bread or Passover in the month of Abib, the Feast of Harvest, which is the first fruits of their labor. So at the end of when they started their harvest after the growing season, of course, the first fruits they would offer to the Lord, they would have a feast then, and then the Feast of End Gathering at the end of the harvest, or end of the year, that I guess when things were finishing up your harvest, and they would have a feast at that time. And that's briefly what those laws cover. I'd encourage you to read through them, and see, how they applied to them keeping the Ten Commandments, and how they amplified on that. And we'll finish up with that. Thank you.